April 16th, come to order. We, let's work down the list on the agenda this morning. Hopefully my committee will show up before too long. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3885. John, can you give us the highlights of the bill, please?
Good morning, Chair Starr and members of the committee. Our first bill this morning is House Bill 3885. It's a rather simple bill. As you can see, it allows operator of motorcycle to dispense motor fuel with assistance of person at retail fueling facilities. And as you probably already know, current law prohibits any dispensation of petroleum fuel by any person of the public at any retail facility. There is no revenue impact. It may have a fiscal impact, but no statement has yet been received as of this morning, Chair.
Thank you very much. I'd like to have Wayne Schumacher, I think it's Mel Yeager and Iris Yeager. The three of you can come together.
Chair Starr, members of the House Transportation Committee, my name is Wayne Schumacher. I've been a resident of Oregon for over 52 years and a motorcyclist for over 34 years. And my purpose here today is to urge your support of House Bill 3885. Different from automobiles, the refueling of a motorcycle is a bit more complex and requires a bit more attention. The variance of the fuel opening location on motorcycles and the tank design tends to make it a more challenging refueling job, particularly with the hose or the fume recovery boots that are required by DEQ. When these devices are slammed, and I do mean slammed into the fuel opening of a car, these devices do not come in contact with any paint or the exterior sheet metal. However, when inserted in a motorcycle tank, it does come in contact with the paint and often results in damage to the paint, scratching or chipping. Again, different from an automobile, the proper refueling of a motorcycle requires the person to perform the task to hold the nozzle and throughout the entire process, as the on-off mechanism does not function like it does when refueling a car. In my case, it's almost impossible to completely fill my motorcycle tank without remaining in the seat, holding the bike upright, and using a special tool that locks the fume recovery boot up and out of the way. This tool is a fork-like device that slips in below the boot and onto a retaining ring that's on the nozzle. This allows me to view the fuel level and prevent spillage. I've rarely seen a gas station with this type of device or tool available. When used by a gas station attendant unfamiliar with the fueling process of a motorcycle, the nozzle fume recovery devices often create a greater chance of spilling, damage to the motorcycle paint, or result in the inability to completely fill the tank. In my experience, that even the most novice riders quickly become adept in the unique skill of refueling their particular make of motorcycle. And for this reason, most riders insist on refueling their own motorcycles. Gas station managers or owners today are faced with a double liability, that of risking costly repair or repainting damage caused by attendants unfamiliar with refueling a motorcycle, or breaking the law by allowing the rider to refuel their own motorcycle. Even experienced gas station attendants prefer to have riders refuel their own motorcycles. They realize the risk and damage to the motorcycle. I'd like to indicate to you, yesterday at our family function on Easter, my brother-in-law is a owner of two gas stations here in Marion County and one in Yamhill. Wanted like crazy to come down to testify on behalf of this bill because he recognizes and has paid several fines from DEQ as well as from has replaced several gas tanks. So he was very interested in this bill. I think you'll find that most gas station owners would have preferred to be here, but again, like he, they've got three stations to attend to and don't have time to come down. Every day, hundreds of citizens of Oregon break the law as motorcycle owners refuel their own motorcycles. Oregon is one of only a few states to still cling to the no self-service laws, and the statistics of other states prove that there's no unusual risk associated with consumers refueling their own vehicles. Though through House Bill 3885, motorcyclists in Oregon are asking the Oregon legislature to amend the state's current fuel dispensing law to allow them to the option of refueling their own motorcycles. I urge the member of the committee to vote yes on House Bill 3885 and to move the bill to the House of Representatives with a due pass recommendation. I'm pleased to answer any questions the committee might have at this point.
Thank you. I think we'll have other two witnesses testify, and then we'll open up for questions.
Thank you, Representative Starr, members of the committee. My name is Mel Yeager. I'm also here in support of House Bill 3885, and we want to make sure that we understand that we are talking an assisted-serve bill here, not a self-serve bill, as may be proposed later on in this session. We are asking for something reasonable to be done here, to amend the law so that motorcyclists can fuel their own tanks legally. My personal experience is that when I've gone into a gas station for fueling, as Wayne Schumacher here just testified, most of the time the gas station owner or attendant will hand me the fuel dispensing nozzle and allow me to fuel my own tank, even though they know that they stand liable for a fine if they're caught doing so. But they would rather take that chance than the chance of damaging my motorcycle, which is just fine with me. We just ask that the committee consider making legal something that has been considered illegal in this state. We think that this would be a benefit to both the motorcyclists and the gas station owners and operators, because it, from a safety and liability standpoint, it just makes good common sense. In subsequent testimony, you'll hear a couple of horror stories of people that were not allowed to fill their own tank, and I think that those two stories will impress you quite effectively and give you a good reason to vote yes on this bill. And I thank you very much, and I'd ask if there's any questions.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Starr and committee. I came in concern of House Bill 3885, which is assisted service gasoline for motorcycles. And as Mel did, I want to emphasize the assisted. We're not in self-service. Assisted, which would require the attendant to hand the nozzle, the service station attendant to hand the nozzle to the motorcyclist who had then put the gasoline into his own machine. The shape, size, and placement of the gasoline tank on motorcycles make the filling of flammable liquids into them a possible danger when done by someone who does not know how to do so correctly. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Berger.
Could you tell me why this was illegal?
Are you?
Any of you?
I'm not real sure why the state fire marshal insisted on this being illegal, but the current law in the state of Oregon says that anybody that is caught by the state fire marshal's office dispensing fuel into their own tank does stand a penalty of $500 fine. This stands for both the operator of the vehicle as well as the owner of the gas station who would allow that person to do that.
I'll follow up, please. Mm-hmm. So to your knowledge, it just painted everybody with one brush when they said you couldn't dispense fuel. That was it, and they didn't specify any exemptions.
That is correct. Representative Verger, that is correct.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. I want to say Pat Ryan, that's close. And somebody has a letter from Representative Wilkes.
James Grassfield, they're asking.
James, you want to come up? Come on up. Go ahead, you may proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I take a summer run every year out of state and travel typically with a friend of mine that lives in Eastmoreland. And on our way back from Colorado last year, we arrived in Hood River. And I stopped off at the exit to fuel my bike. We were told that they would be dispensing the fuel, as is currently the law. My friend declined to fuel his bike, being concerned about his finish on his tank and so on. And I sort of went ahead and let him do it. And it was also a station where you have to pay in advance, so I was required to go in, deposit some amount that was larger than the amount I was going to be buying, and in the process, in the meantime, they filled up my tank. Didn't spill any gas on it. But most motorcycles lean to the left when they're on the kickstand, and the fill spot is typically at the high right-hand point of the tank, which is the distance highest off the ground. So these folks filled it all the way to the very top, and I screwed the top on and got my bike up to vertical and re-entered the freeway, and immediately gas started coming out of my breather tube and running down my tank. What wound up happening is the right leg of my pants was coated with gasoline, which, as you know, is a little bit caustic and kind of, you know, it burns your skin. And in addition, I'm real concerned that the exhaust pipes on the engines are directly underneath the tank. So I'm sort of riding and wiping, which is very unsafe. Basically, I had to wait until the bike had burned enough fuel to lower the fuel level. And luckily, got under some rain once I got down into the gorge a little bit, and that kind of, you know, neutralized my leg a little bit. And got home, and then the next day went ahead and washed the bike and had to sort of repolish everything out. There was no fire, and I was happy that that had occurred. But, you know, as the bike pack folks had said earlier, I think most attendants, regardless of their youth, just tend to assume that best practices is to allow us to fuel our own tanks. And, you know, I've been riding a bike for 35 years, and it really is best practices for us as far as safety goes. And I guess that's about it.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Please.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chris Turk. I am Representative Carl Wilson's legislative assistant. I am delighted to be here on this Monday morning when we're all still waking up. I'm going to be testifying on Representative Wilson's behalf on HB 3885. My voice isn't quite as polished or resonating, but I hope you'll forgive me.
Nobody did.
I'll do my best, though. My thanks to the Chair of the Transportation Committee for hearing and considering this bill. I regret that I am unable to attend this morning's hearing, but I must say that there is no single piece of legislation that is more important and significant to motorcyclists this session. As you have noticed, motorcycles are not what they used to be. It is hard to find a cheap bike. Many of the bikes on the road today sell for $15,000 to $25,000. These bikes can cost even more because of pricey accessories and custom paint. These custom paint jobs are becoming more commonplace, with paint alone costing thousands of dollars. These bikes are the pride and joy of their owners. Owners show uncommon devotion to these bikes, going to great lengths to keep them clean and in showroom condition. Most motorcycle gas tanks present a great difficulty when it comes to filling them with gasoline. Many, like my own bike, offer a filler hole just barely larger than the diameter of the dispensing nozzle. One must develop a knack to fill it. One must have an idea of the tank volume and be able to have a feel for when the tank is getting close to capacity. I will do anything to keep the tank from overfilling. To do so would risk serious damage to my custom paint and the potential for spilling gasoline on a hot engine. I certainly cannot expect an attendant to feel comfortable trying to fill my tank. My tank is unique to my brand of bike, and every brand offers its own special difficulties in filling. If I were a gas attendant, I would love to hand the nozzle to a rider and avoid the risk of fuel spillage for a number of reasons. I would hate to ever face a stranger, ruin the wax or paint on his or her custom bike, and lose my job for chipping the paint by a misdirected nozzle. My boss would probably fire me when the motorcyclist filed suit, and he or she will if I ruin the paint. This is not the proverbial front wheel under the tent. Most bikes have no overflow recess, and there is no room for error. Cars do not take on fuel in the matter of motorcycles. Mr. Chair and the committee, this bill is good for motorcyclists, attendants, and gas station owners. Thanks for your thoughtful consideration.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Mr. Chair and committee, I was in Lublin, Oregon riding one day, and I seemed to have an electrical problem underneath the dash of my bike. Pulled over to the side of the road to fix the problem. In the process, I broke a vent tube. I was running low on gas, and I fixed it as well as I could to make it into Lebanon to buy a part to fix the bike. Coming into Lebanon, I pulled into a Chevron station because my bike started to hesitate. I was running out of gas, and I knew that I'd have to push the bike at least 7 or 8 blocks before I could get the part to get it repaired and then push it back to the gas station. Well, when I pulled in there, the station attendant showed up, and they asked me what type of gas I preferred. I said premium, and he started to pump the gas, and I asked him if I could do it. He said no because of a new state law. Well, I told him I did not want him to fill it up all the way because the vent tube across the top, the clamp was broke. He started to fill the right-hand side of my bike, which is the high side of the bike, the wrong tank to begin with. And I told him about it, so then he immediately went to the low side and started putting gas in there. Then he went back to the right side and started to fill it back up. And as he was filling it, I told him once more, don't fill it all the way. And I thought he had it under control. So I went to grab my wallet, which is on a chain lanyard. And wearing gloves, it slipped out of my hand. It fell backwards. I turned to grab it, and I came back up, and he had already filled it up above the vent tube. Gas started leaking through there into where the dash panel sits, and there's an OEM, which is original equipment manufactured part, switch there, that has open contacts, which concerned me greatly at that point. Not only that, but about a half a pint of gas went down onto the top of my motor and started to steam up, which made the gas more volatile at that point. If I hadn't recognized what was going on and turned the ignition switch on, it could have possibly ignited the bike at that time. I let him know that I was not very pleased with what had happened, and I asked him why did he fill it all the way up, and he said that he didn't hear me. Okay. So I pushed the bike over to the side of the gas station, let it air out, dried it off, and had to remove some of the gas from the tank and put it in a cup. At that point, I didn't have any way to dispose of that, so I walked it out and set it down by the pump. I do have a display here from old parts since I couldn't bring my motorcycle in. I'd like to explain how the tanks are set up with a vent tube. They even brought the dash for the electrical contact where that sits. These are two-piece tanks. As you can see, I have half a tank here. The dash itself sits like so, and it's mounted onto the back of the frame. The main wiring harness always runs down the ridge back on the frame, which goes right through here. The vent tube, which goes across here to the other tank. This one was loose, and it started to leak down inside. And the
into the open contact switch, which is a ONE. What I'm really concerned about is, as you see in my letter there, I state that individuals that work or pay for their own car, truck, snowmobile, whatever, boat, have a tendency to take more care of what they're doing when they're with that object than an individual that's just locking up and going to pump gas. That's all I've got to say.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Ken Ray is the only one else signed up. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify besides Ken? You're up, Ken.
Thank you. Chairman Starr, members of the committee, I'm not going to give any long testimony after that. All I can say is, as Executive Director of Bike Pack, this is a bill that we support and ask you to pass it out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3885. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3885.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley.
I move HB 3885 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Merkley has moved House Bill 3885 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? We have a roll call vote, please.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Krupp?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Representative
Berger? Aye.
Representative
Zahner? Aye. Chair Stock? Aye. Motion passed.
Who wants to
carry the bill?
Representative
Zahner? Representative Zahner is going
to
carry the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to offer Representative Zahner my leather pants. If like.
Are they extra large? I might.
They stretch wonderfully, I can assure you.
Oh, boy. We'll close the work session House Bill 3885. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3206. And, John, you want to hit the bill and then Representative Butler's here.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, House Bill 3206. Authorizes sign adjacent to State Highway for certain nonprofit entities if sign meets specified criteria. You have no revenue impact on this bill. However, we were just delivered the fiscal statement, which each one of you should have before you this morning. It has the potential of triggering Section 15, Article 11 of the Oregon Constitution, and you need to address the impact, but it does certainly have a fiscal impact on this bill.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Butler. I'm from House District 60. I tell you all about the good things about House District 60, but I'm not going to tell you all of the great things about House District 60 because the population is staying just about where we need it, and even though my district might get about 4,000 miles bigger, and the redistricting is still the greatest place in the state of Oregon to live, and it's a good place. It's a good place for the State Department of Transportation to have a sign from place to place, and we have one in Ontario. Let me tell you about the sign just briefly. The sign is on the state highway. It's a reader board sign for the cultural center. Now, the cultural center, the state of Oregon has a rather substantial investment through the Lottery Commission. It's where the Oregon Tourism Convention has just been held this past week ago right now. And it's a very important place in Eastern Oregon, Ontario being the headquarters of most of the economic activity that goes on. In anticipation of the Beltline going around Ontario and the abandonment of the state highway through Ontario, the city of Ontario went ahead and authorized a sign placement, recognizing that there are other signs on the in the downtown core of Ontario, authorized a sign placement for the cultural center. The cultural center is on the campus of Treasure Valley Community College, and so the activities that are advertised on the reader board by limitation are items that are happening in the cultural center, events of community interest at the college or in the cultural center. Right across the street, there's a sign in the public park that hangs out over the state highway, over the portion of the, I guess it doesn't hang over, but it's adjacent to the sidewalk on the state highway, where other public events are for the high school and church and community events are advertised. But that must come under a grandfather clause because it advertises other kinds of events in the community. The situation in paragraph number 4 under section 2 basically says the sign is on property adjacent to a segment of state highway that the Department of Transportation expects to turn over to the city within 10 years of the effective date of this 2001 act. And certainly that's the case that this highway will eventually become just a city street. I'm told in order to accomplish what needs to be accomplished here, even though this sign is on nonprofit property, the property belongs to the Dominican Sisters, the hospital, and that the Dominican Sisters are a major contributor to both the college and to the cultural center, that the sign can't continue to exist even though it was permitted by the city. We're in a catch-22. And I understand that there is some fiscal impact, and now I'm wondering if in this fiscal impact, the loss that Oregon may sustain if we come in and tell the federal government, hey, wait a minute, this is so narrow that we may not hurt anyone in this process. A sign on nonprofit property advertising nonprofit activities on the adjacent property supported by the other, and yet I'm told that we risk $20 million in loss of funds. And I have to ask myself, if we just told the federal government, fine, we'll start losing $20 million of federal highway funds, could the state of Oregon, through its tourism and through its advertising of the businesses in the state of Oregon, could we maybe attract $40 or $50 million of additional general fund revenues? And I recognize that's not money that goes back onto the highways, but could we attract that money back into the state of Oregon and perhaps do ourselves a greater good by saying, we'll take control of our own highways without the federal dollars involved. So relative to these sign matters. Again, this is a very narrow case. I'd have you look at it in its narrow constriction that is demonstrated here. This is a nonprofit activity. These are all for the community good. And I want you to know that virtually, with the exception of hundreds of thousands of dollars of locally donated money, and the Japanese American community and some of the other communities across the United States which have donated money to the Cultural Center, which was set up under the Japanese relocation program from a number of years ago, this Cultural Center is largely publicly supported. And I hesitate to have these folks go in and take I think it came from Regional Strategies, the money that was used to put the sign up. I'd sure hate to have them go in and say, yeah, you've got a permitted sign under Regional Strategies, and now you're going to have to take it down. It just doesn't make a great deal of sense. But I bring that to you today because I believe in my own heart of hearts that the narrow constriction of the reading of this bill would be such that I can't imagine it would create a great deal of heartburn for the feds. But should it create that heartburn, I would just encourage you to take a look at it in light of the fact that maybe we don't need all of the federal regulations coming in and telling us what we need to do and what we should do and what's correct for our communities, particularly where this won't be a state highway in a number of years, depending upon when we get the last of our overpasses rebuilt. That's when all of the state highways in downtown Ontario basically go away.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions, Representative Verger.
Representative, I'm not sure what makes that sign illegal.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, obviously the folks in Ontario are wondering the same thing. It's not on the premises of the cultural center. Even though it's on the parking lot that the cultural center has leased, It's not on the premises of the cultural center, and it is so narrowly defined that I can't hardly imagine that I'm here asking for this, and yet there is some concern that because the property is not owned by the cultural center and not used on a day-to-day basis by the cultural center other than for its parking, overflow parking, that's the concern that the Oregon Department of Transportation has with the U.S. Department of Transportation.
Let me get that straight. The sign is illegal because the business or the organization that is advertising, they don't own the land the sign's on?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. They do not own the property that the sign is physically located on, even though they have the approval and a lease as necessary, a signed lease as necessary for the overflow parking there. The sign is, in fact, adjacent to the block. It's a parking block, and there's a former bank building there. But this is not the bank sign. It's a sign. It's a community sign that's been set up there to advertise the college, which is the college and the cultural center, which start one block off of the main highway.
Representative Dillon.
Mr. Chairman, maybe it'd be good for me to give a couple of examples of where I've run into this before. Many people may recognize my district's divided by I-5. I've got quite a few businesses along I-5. I've had two motels and hotels approach me during my tenure here in the legislature on this very same issue, wanting to get signs closer to the freeway, et cetera, being denied because what they were trying to do was to lease space close to the freeway to erect new signs because they didn't feel their signs were visible. And I've had the same comments actually from ODOT on the same issue. And, I might like to stub my nose as much at the federal government as Representative Butler, but the penalty is potentially pretty severe. And potentially the issue is a little bit broader too, in the sense that there are a lot of freeway-oriented businesses that many of which would like to, acquire land close to the freeway so they could put their signs out there as opposed to being 400 yards in or 200 yards in from the freeway where they're actually located.
The difference I might see is I-5 as opposed to a state highway that runs through the middle of town.
And particularly one that's going to probably ultimately come under a local jurisdiction.
If you look at state highways that run through my district, highways 6 and 8,
right,
and 8 and 10, the TV highway. I'm Representative Berger.
It seems to me that the distinct difference here is that you're talking about a business that might want to promote something, and everybody would want to do that. This is a community and a college and a cultural event, which to me is a very distinct difference. We have a reader board that advertises the college and cultural events in Coos Bay on Newmark. That's one of the state highways that is now a city street. It is on college property, and that's the difference that I can see. However, you have permission from the people who own the property for a signed lease, and I find it lacks common sense that you would not be able to maintain that sign for a nonprofit cultural activity.
Mr. Chair, Representatives Verger and Devlin, this is a concern where the property is on private, or the sign is on private property, and it is on 501c3 charitable owned private property. Again, it's the Dominican Sisters Hospital, which is a supporter of the cultural center. And I serve presently on the board of the cultural center, and assisted in the writing and the rewriting and the recent revisions relative to the kinds of activities that can be advertised on the reader board. The reader board does not advertise any for-profit, no commercial activities of any way, shape, or form. Whereas the reader board across the street that fronts the same highway just a half a block further in the same block It advertises church events, it advertises civic events, it advertises sales, it advertises the kinds of things for nonprofits and for profits alike, the Downtown Merchants Association activities and those kinds of things. But it's probably a grandfathered sign in relationship to this sign, which is not grandfathered. Again, I would call in reference to what Representative Devlin has indicated, this is not a freeway. It's a 30-mile-an-hour area, which has already been the restrictions on the highway. The State Highway Department is managing in conjunction with the City of Ontario all of the restrictions to access to this highway right now, as we're in a morphing and the transition from state highway to city highway to city street, in effect. And that's what makes this so unique, is that we're right now morphing in the process, and that's why the section 2 subparagraph 4 provides that this may be a state highway today. It's a low speed state highway that goes through the City of Ontario, but it's designed and expected to be turned over to the city as a city street. With a lot of the state issues already in place, we're not contesting those. We're saying we can work together. We can work cooperatively and collaboratively with the state in managing these things. This was one more item that we had anticipated again, and the building permit was issued by the city in anticipation of the actual modification of this moving from any state ownership over to the demise of it as a state, because the state will now be belt lining and bypassing the downtown portion of Ontario, which people could look at that and say, well, that's a bad thing. The City of Ontario is saying that's probably a good thing. It probably benefits traffic by and large. And in that regard, again, is the loss so great that I'm not requesting that this turn into some sort of a downtown Las Vegas, but certainly that we have the ability to advertise nonprofit activities. And this is not uncommon throughout the state. I see signs advertising museums and so forth out on public lands, probably not sanctioned by the highway department. As long as no one is complaining about them, they just stay there.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Butler, I understand that there is room for disagreement about the federal law, but the particular concern that is raised in the fiscal statement is not just the loss of federal funds, but also that this may actually be seen as an unfunded mandate that would obligate the state to reimburse local governments if, in fact, that loss of funds did come to pass. So I think in your other capacity, you probably could address that concern.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, good call. I haven't seen the fiscal that's just been issued. All I've got is just the letter from the Department of Transportation concerned about the $20.5 million that the state may lose in federal funds. But if there is some sort of an unfunded mandate, we certainly have to weigh all of the factors. My concern here is if we could get the federal folks to come along with us, whatever would be necessary. If you'd like to turn this into a joint House memorial and resolution that the highways that are being dedicated because of belt lines going around cities, that the highways that are eventually going to be dedicated should perhaps, whether being worked cooperatively and collaboratively between the local municipalities, should perhaps be given some greater latitude in that interim, I would be amenable to that. But these folks have a very unique situation, and the cultural center, had this fact come up earlier, the cultural center probably would have located out on the main state highway, and that wouldn't have been a desirable situation. So it's a six of one and half a dozen of another, and it's certainly the devil here is in the details. So,
President Donner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and probably Al Leitner can probably help us with this one. I've had some sign problems in my county also, but the sign at Volcano Stadium is an illegal sign, but they got permission from the city to keep it up there, some kind of a waiver, as I understand it. So now it doesn't make it, now it's proper. It's not illegal, according to the rules. So how does that affect, why is that able to be up there and not your sign? I would like
Mr. Chair, that
because that's pretty visible, and it's right in my county, and I'm trying to get those questions answered, so I guess Al is probably the answer.
I think Al will come up in a minute, and he can answer that. I think Representative Murphy has another question for
you. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Butler, I'm sympathetic with the situation you're in. If because of the fiscal, we end up doing a memorial or something, I hope there's some other creative way to tackle this thing, maybe an early transfer by the state of the land or shared ownership of by the cultural center in the land where the land, where the sign sits, or some other fashion. It seems strange to have a highway that looks like a city street, 30 miles per hour, as you noted, and not be able to advertise your local events.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Merkley. I would say this, this cries out for some sort of solution, and I think with the combined gray matter, inside, not outside, combined gray matter that is represented in this committee and with the Department of Transportation, I would think that somehow we could be able to overcome this, and I wish it was as easy as Representative Zahner has indicated, that because it was, in fact, the city that issued the building permit, recognizing that this was going to be a city street within just a few years. At the time, we believed it was going to be a city street much faster. We're now told that even with the construction of the Beltway, which is in progress and underway, that until they finish the actual connection to the existing one of the existing overhead off-ramps, overpasses, that they may delay the actual transfer of this portion of the public highway over to the city, but the city is basically treating it as its own at this point, manages it and operates it, but still in all, the costs have been borne. And I don't want to minimize the amount that the state has borne in establishing the highway and getting it prepared for delivery to the city. That they've done a nice overlay on it a number of years ago. They've continued to take care of the striping and the other kinds of issues that are important. But I wish that it was so simple that we could just go ahead and cooperatively own it together until such time as it eventually. And again, I would look to the committee and the Department of Transportation for any kind of a solution which could address these particular types of things without the loss of large sums of federal highway dollars.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Butler, this, I understand this is within the city limits of Ontario?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Brown, yes, indeed it is. It sits just below the hospital. The hospital used to be in the outskirts of Ontario, but the hospital is downtown in Ontario now, and so this is across from a city park and then across from the college campus. In the meantime, the private property, which used to be owned privately, is now has now been purchased by the hospital as an annex to the hospital, and then the parking has been cooperatively shared with the cultural center, so that the cultural center has access to the overflow parking and thus the sign, which is in relationship to the park. And there is a former old bank building that's there, which it's my understanding that the bank or that the hospital continues to use for various activities, but presently isn't being used for any commercial purposes, and there's no commercial purpose there.
Then, if it's within the city limits of Ontario and it's on private property, it's not on the highway right away, why doesn't city ordinance prevail? Why don't they control outdoor advertising yet?
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Brown, I would surely think that somehow city ordinance would prevail, and again, the city approved in open meeting the establishment, and then the city did authorize the building permit for the sign, and the city was the co-applicant and assisted in the process to make sure that the funds got into the sign itself through the regional strategy. I don't know that they were the co-applicant as much as they were the tacit approver of the of issuing the permit, but in that process, the The sign certainly went up with the city's blessing and with the city's permit, with the building permit and so forth, recognizing that the property was eminent to be moved to the domain of just the city and not the state highway. Again, that's gone a little slower than what we'd anticipated. I think that when we were told that the funds were available back in 1997, we knew that it was going to happen. When we were told that they were going to be starting construction in 1999 without fail, we felt like that, you know, that was going to happen. We're at 2001, and there isn't so much as a shovel full of dirt turned, but I think the city is still very moving very proactively, as if the state highway will bypass and come into a belt line around Ontario, at which point, other than just the freeway connection, which is just a few hundred yards of city streets and state highways and the Olds Ferry Road, which is part of the Oregon Trail Highway, all of those then come into play at that point. But the concern that I've got is that the immediate problem is that they would like to continue to utilize this sign, and I think that probably the sign would never have come in question had it not been for just some folks at the ODOT that came back and said, gee, it doesn't look like we'll get that transferred quite as fast. Maybe you shouldn't have gone ahead with the sign. And like I say, I was going to be a fairly young man when this was going to be dedicated to the city of Ontario, and I'm not getting any younger, and it's still not dedicated. So I'd love to have seen it happen 4 to 6 years ago when we were told that it was imminent of happening then, at that time.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Butler, it's really ironic that under these ORSs that we have conflicts. And for example, if this cultural center were a viticulture area, since the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms have defined viticulture areas as scenic attractions and cultural sites, they may have these signs. Now, this is ironic to me. And so maybe we need to have a different designation, but also under ORS 377, what is really required is an affidavit from the city or county, and under 377.725, with the director's permission, the sign should be allowed. So I don't know, you know, I think this is sad that this would happen, and I think there is room here for the sign to continue the way I interpret this, and I'd have to be told differently.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I would hope that we'd be able to craft some sort of solution that would bridge us between today and that beautiful, faithful, eventful day in which we will see the state say the highway now no longer belongs to the Oregon Department of Transportation, but you can have it back as a city street.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Butler, very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Lightner.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, my name is Al Lightner. I'm with the Department of Transportation Right-of-Way Project Administration. I've been affiliated, associated, and whatever else might be associated with the Outdoor Advertising Sign Control Program. This is the jurisdiction that governs billboards. And it's not an on-premise sign, it's an off-premise sign, and that's the dilemma that we face. It's not the state law that causes the dilemma here, it's the federal law. You can pass this bill, and it will solve the state law dilemma. But it doesn't change the federal law dilemma. Oregon has an agreement that they will uphold the federal law or the Federal Highway Beautification Act. And that is where the rub is, because if we don't, then we're subject to $20 million a year in penalties. And it doesn't come out of just ODOT. It comes out of ODOT and cities and counties that use federal highway funds. So that's the problem. And I would dearly love to solve it. And I see one possibility of solving it, but it would take some action at the federal level to get some sort of a waiver or a change in federal law or regulation that interprets that state highways routed over platted city streets, once they go back to the local jurisdiction, that the federal requirement is removed. And we also have county roads where that's the same thing, where we have resoluted rights of way. We have no ownership and fee title. And that ought to be the same case. So this isn't the only one of these kinds of signs that we have around the state. This is a very unique one. It's very closely, tightly defined as to exactly what it is, but it does run afoul of state and federal law, plain and simple. And changing the jurisdiction to a city street and removing the state route designation won't change that, because it's the federal law, not the state. I'd be more than happy to keep working with whomever would like to work on this. We've been working on it now for almost a year. And there was a question from Representative Zahner about the Kaiser Volcano sign. That sign is on the premises of the Kaiser Volcano's property.
Yeah.
And it advertises, for the most part, Kaiser Volcano activities or things conducted at that premise. There are a couple of add-on logos, so to speak, that don't. And those are under a violation notice right at this time. So it isn't that we don't enforce the law. We do. We enforce it evenly and fairly and uniformly. We cannot judge a sign by its content. We've just come through the Supreme Court on issues like that, and we've prevailed. We're very careful in that. And so there are a lot of things that are tied to this issue. But basically, it's a billboard problem. State and federal law apply. And I don't.
You've got lots of questions up here.
Yeah, I don't know where to go next, because I think there's lots of questions.
Maybe we should all run for Congress and change the federal law.
Here.
No. The question I have is, I drive Highway 26 on a daily basis, and there are two new billboards that were just constructed on right on the highway, right behind the shopping area that holds the now defunct Home Place, Ross, Old Navy. There's two massive billboards that are found in there. My guess is that the owners of those, explain how that works, because it doesn't seem to me that the billboard company is the same owner that the people that own the land or own the strip mall.
Chair Starr, typically billboards are placed on property that other people own under some sort of a lease or rental agreement. The one in question, or the two in question, do they have copy on them yet? Okay. That's the issue. The company that's erected those billboards was the one that just lost in Supreme Court. They got a local building permit to put up a structure, and that's fine. When they put on copy, if it's for advertising for goods and services or activities not on that premise, then they will violate the state and federal law. Okay? I think they're waiting for us to jump at them for putting up a structure. Until they put up an off-premise sign, Oregon law and federal law doesn't doesn't have any jurisdiction. So it's...
Interesting. Right smack dab in the middle of a constitutional crisis here. And
it's got lots of tentacles.
Thank you. Other questions? Justin's honor.
Thank you, Mr. Starr. The Volcano Stadium sign is advertising the Oregon Gardens. How do they justify that? That's not on the premises.
Representative Starr, Representative Zahner, I don't know how they do.
How do the feds look at that? Isn't that part of the federal rule?
I believe Representative Starr, Representative Zahner, again, we're being tested.
One more quick follow-up. If they owned that property instead of leased it, if they... Would that change the rules in Ontario?
Representative Starr, Representative Zahner, yes. If it's on their premises, then it's fine.
Do they buy it for a dollar? Or?
I don't care what they do.
I know, Al.
Representative Devlin.
Al has been working real well with me, and so he has great patience. And if you're around me very often, you know what that means.
Yeah, we all need it. Well. Thank you. Representative Devlin.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. In partial defense of the federal requirement, can you give some recognition of, well, if you're putting signs that are not part of your property, why that would be such a big issue? Because I can see it very clearly. I mean, I have a district that's, like I say, divided by I-5. There are a lot of businesses that would like to purchase 100 square feet close to I-5 and erect signs up that were more visible from the freeway. And if the federal government permitted that, there would be a lot of sort of sign farms going up and down the freeway in terms of people buying a quarter acre here or an eighth of an acre there in order to be able to erect signs away from their premises. Because if you get into large interchanges, many times there are dozens and dozens of businesses that go back, you know, 150 yards. They would all like to have a sign that was actually right on the freeway. I mean, I made your statement, but but there is some basis for why the requirement was there.
Representative Starr, Representative Devlin, very quickly, yes, there is also a distance requirement that anticipates the sign farm concept.
Other questions?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I did want to state one thing because it's not a big deal, but I'm not normally so discourteous as to be reading the newspaper while there's testimony given, but I'm not actually reading the newspaper. I'm preparing testimony for a meeting tomorrow. Mrs. Carter.
Do it on your own.
All right, sure. Representative Murphy. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did I understand you to say that even if the state designation is taken off the road and it becomes a city street, the sign would still not be permitted?
Representative Starr, Representative Merkley, that is correct.
So, if I can continue, the federal rule applies to ordinary city streets?
Representative Starr, Representative Merkley, any highway that has been in the federal aid highway system prior to 1991 or the national highway system since will always carry the federal requirement for sign control, according to federal policy and regulation and code.
So the solution that Representative Butler was presenting is not really a solution in your opinion of this highway being handed back over?
Representative Starr, Representative Merkley, will not solve the problem. It will keep Oregon exposed to a $20 million per year penalty on federal aid funds.
Chair, is this road also have a federal designation, or is it just solely a state designation?
Representative Starr, Representative Merkley, I believe it has a federal designation. I believe it's on the, I'd have to check. It used to be on the federal aid urban. I believe it would still be part of the national system because of that, as far as the sign program goes. Whether it's on the current national highway system, I would have to check. But it definitely carries the federal aid urban designation prior to 1991, and that's what keeps it subject to this penalty.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Anyone else want to testify on this bill? Close the public hearing on House Bill 3206 and open a work session on House Bill 3206. committee. Lieutenant Butler would like to work on this bill some more. He'd like to see if he can find that solution, maybe crafted in the form of a memorial. Because of the fiscal on it, it's appropriate to send it to Ways and Means. Representative Butler chairs an appropriate committee there that could have jurisdiction over this issue. He'd like to have the bill and work the bill, see if he can find some kind of middle ground or solution. What the chair would appreciate is an aye vote to send it to the Ways and Means Committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I move the bill as indicated to the Ways and Means Committee without recommendation.
Representative Devlin has moved House Bill 3206 to the Ways and Means Committee without recommendation. Is there objection? Seeing none, so moved. That will close the work session on House Bill 3206. With that, we will open the public hearing on House Bill 3069. John, can you give us the highlights, please?
Mr. Chair, sorry, members of the committee, House Bill 3069 requires Oregon Department of Transportation to take inventory of certain highway signs, requires all construction plans to account for and protect signs, requires ODOT to also pay compensation for signs kept out of service for a specified number of days due to construction, and it declares an emergency effective on passage. Members of the committee, we just delivered the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3069, and what I just explained to you as far as what the original bill does. The amendment basically does not do, it deletes a lot of what was just stated by just requiring ODOT to report to the 77th legislature about the current status of the signs and deletes all the fines. I would assume very, very confidently that that would, of course, change any fiscal impact on the bill. There is no revenue impact on this bill, and no fiscal statement has yet been delivered. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Doug Findle, Scott West.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott West, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Lodging Association and over 1,100 members statewide, the hotels, motels, bed and breakfasts, resorts, and RV parks in the state of Oregon. House Bill 3069 was initiated due to problems stemming from loss or damage to tourism-oriented directional signs and also the specific service logo signs that occurred during ODOT construction projects. Current ODOT regulations require that these signs are protected during these projects, specifically that if they are going to be moved or impacted, they're either put on temporary standards until such time that they can go back to permanent standards. There are also calls for liquidated damages in the case when these signs are down for any period longer than 5 days. For each day longer than 5 days, there's a $200 assessment that's assigned to these contractors. Unfortunately, over the last couple of years, we've experienced a number of these incidents where these signs have been down for extended periods of time, either lost, totally damaged, or once again for a long period of time. Here in the Troutdale area, a sign was lost, never to be found, was out of service for 6 months. One here in the Salem area, there's an attraction sign that was down for 3 months. It was eventually found in a trash heap, a construction trash heap, and there was another issue down in Southern Oregon here just recently, last year, a camping sign spent about a month under a similar trash heap. As you can imagine, the businesses that pay for these signs are detrimentally impacted during this process. We've been working with ODOT since last fall when we brought this to their attention, had some discussions about how we might address this problem without coming to the legislature, and had some discussions about creating a sign protection plan. There's been a lot of movement, a very positive movement in that way. We're very encouraged by that. And in fact, we understand recently that there's been a plan that's been put into place to address the issues with more communication between ODOT themselves, the construction contractors, and also the Travel Information Council, which is the entity that manages and addresses these blue, as you see them on the highway, the blue logo and the tourism directional signs. In the past few days, we've reached agreement with ODOT with regard to some amendments that Administrator so ably identified to you today that essentially takes out the penalty phase of the bill itself and instead institutes a reporting phase, because we're confident that 2 years from now that we'll be sitting here with ODOT and the Travel Information Council talking about the great gains we've made in this arena. We were very pleased that Joan Robinson worked very diligently to get these amendments to you in a very timely manner, and so we're very thrilled that she did so. Unfortunately, from our behalf, the negotiations continued a little later into late Thursday, and we weren't able to get some other amendments to you, which would have deleted Section 2 and Section 4 of the bill, which calls for ODOT to make an overall inventory across the state. That's certainly unnecessary at this point, and we would hope that we could get those amendments and get this back to you at a later time. With those and with our cooperative efforts with ODOT, we would encourage your support of this bill, and I offer myself up for any questions.
Great. Doug, you want to take a shot at questions?
Chair Starr, members of the committee, Doug Tindall, maintenance engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I've appreciated the opportunity to work with Scott on this. We do recognize the instances that Scott's talked about where we've adversely impacted businesses specifications should have been clear enough to take care of that, but for whatever reason, they weren't. So what Scott referred to is now in what's called a special provision on all of our contracts that the contractor furnish a sign protection plan for the Travel Information Council signs. This is just being put in place now. What will happen with that plan is actually they have to have two copies of it. It will discuss when the signs will come down, when the signs will go back up, and where those things will happen. Those copies of those plans will be delivered to the Travel Information Council, and they'll work with the businesses to make sure that everybody's clear on what the plan is, so that there's not, I think there's been some confusion that the sign went down and the businesses thought it was going to come back up. We lost it for whatever reason, or the contractor lost it and we didn't see it and forgot about it, and this should clear that up so everybody's on the same page. The amendment that you don't have that Scott talked about is the amendment that gets rid of the fiscal, because TIC actually has the inventory of all those signs, not ODOT, and this would require ODOT to go back and do a re-inventory, and there was some fiscal impact to doing that, but it was sections 2 and 4 removed. That takes care of that problem. So we appreciate the opportunity to work with the business community. This is an area we can get better at, and we look forward to doing so.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions, Representative Donner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What signs are we talking about? Blue ones on the freeway, or big signs, or what size?
Mr. Chair, Representative Donner, yes. It's the blue signs that you'll see on near intersections. Either the tourism-oriented directional signs are the ones that will just say gas, food, and lodging. Then you also have the logo boards, whether it be specific businesses that will be identified. There'll be lodging, restaurants, gas stations, camping, and attractions, I believe, are the five. So you'll see, Sherry's Restaurant, or you might see Holiday Inn, or you'll see the Crown Plaza there, Representative Devlin's exit there.
Any other questions?
Do you know all the exits of us on the committee?
Chair Starr, Representative Krupp, no.
Checking.
Chair, Representative Devlin.
I think I have probably. Do I have the busiest interchange on I-5?
Yes.
Which one?
Yes,
that'll be close. 17.
I drive it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're right.
It's a mess. That's getting better. That's something else.
Hope so.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. West, what I perceive here is that you have removed all the penalties.
Chairman Starr, Representative Nelson, that's correct. Although in the existing regulations, there still are penalties that ODOT can assess against the contractor itself. The bill, as originally introduced, assessed fines directly on ODOT.
Is that, follow up, Mr. Chair, is that still in here somewhere? I don't see that.
Chairman, Representative Nelson, is the, I'm assuming the question is are the regulations, the assessments against their liquidated damages against the contractors themselves in there? They're not in the bill specifically, but they certainly are within the ODOT's. Correct.
And what?
Chair Starr, Representative Nelson, they're in the standard specifications for highway construction. There's a provision for liquidated damage against a contractor for not replacing these signs.
Real quick.
Representative Zahner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick. So you guys have given up the fine thing, but ODOT would still get the money. Why wouldn't you pass that money on to the Lodging Association? They're the ones losing the money.
Chair Starr, Representative Zahner, our legal guys weren't sure we could do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. With that, we will close the public hearing on the bill. And we'll open a work session on House Bill 2585. I move House Bill 2585 to the Ways and Means Committee with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection?
Chair.
Representative Merkley.
Yes. I would be quite comfortable if we were for this simply without recommendation. But when we had testimony on this before, it's clear this puts us in an awkward position of choosing particular projects that are would operate and be approved and promoted outside of the STIP, since we need some comprehensive way in the state to assess and compare projects, I'm quite uncomfortable moving it forward with a due pass recommendation, but I certainly would support moving it forward without such a recommendation.
I appreciate that very much for Representative Merkley. The and to a certain extent, I certainly agree with you, but I think that I think we all know the fate of this bill when it gets to Ways and Means. I'm a realist. But I think that what we do is we send messages, and this is one way to send it. And I think a due pass is one way to maybe elevate its importance, recognizing that the intersection that the bill addresses is a extremely dangerous one. And I'd just like to raise the level of awareness primarily to the department, the Oregon Transportation Commission, to the Ways and Means Committee about this particular intersection. So I appreciate your comments very much. Can I assume I have a no vote there, maybe two? We got two?
Mr. Chair, I'm sympathetic to the message you're sending.
Okay.
Let's just, a no vote.
Okay, we'll have a roll call.
Representative Brown?
No.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Krupp?
Aye.
Representative Merkley?
No.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
No.
Representative Berger?
Excused.
Representative Zahner?
Aye.
Chair Starr?
Aye. Motion passes. We're open to work session on House Bill 2741.
What is that?
I move House Bill 2741 to Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair.
We can have a repeat of the previous conversation and we can vote.
It probably comes as no surprise that my philosophy expressed in the previous bill applies to this one also.
Appreciate that very much. Let's have a roll call vote, please.
Representative Brown?
No.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Krupp?
Aye.
Representative Merkley?
No.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
No.
Representative
Berger? Excuse.
Representative
Zahner? Yes, aye.
Chair Starr?
Aye. Motion passes. That was a work session on House Bill 2741. And we were done with our work, and we're done a little early, so back to our other business. So we're adjourned.